Yeah, if you look into that program, honorable members, you'll see that today we're supposed to have a briefing by Jamie on energy bill and electricity distribution in the Southern Cape. Unfortunately, the electricity distribution in the Southern Cape won't be covered here because it seems that there are still some modalities that are being finalized in the cabinet. About this, and so I think affected departments also want to have input on this bill, in particular in FALSA and I think local government and so forth. So as a result, so we will therefore not have the representation on electricity in the industry. We will only have a presentation on energy bill. And if you look into the next Tuesday, 13th, there will be a meeting of the Environmental Affairs and Policy. We will be revisiting the MPRTA and NIM, and remember there were some challenges in terms of making NEMA and the MPRTA IDA. We will be attending that meeting next Tuesday. And on Wednesday, we thought that it is important because we are approaching the budget vote. We thought that it is important to have this budget training before we even have the briefing of the budget board. I had a meeting yesterday with the control group, Secretary of Community Election. That's when we restructured this program in this session. We felt like budget training, that is, we are trying here to get members equipped with how to interrogate budget. So we thought that we are trying to get hold of we in the Chairperson Forum we once had a very brainstorming session, a training session by APREC, an organization I think affiliated to the King Town, very good from the project training. It trained us I was trying to get there. I'm usually busy, and some of them have worked for treasure. That's why they are good, because they understand the issues. So I was trying to told the control secretary that they must try and get hold of these people to come and train us, if possible. And you'll understand what. It was once upon a time training how much very good. And then we have then in once I've had that training I think it will flow very easily, therefore the budget briefing the budget board briefing by Jimmy on the following week, Wednesday the 25th. And then we have to finalize the MPRTA, as you know. I think we will be in a position, probably better put, in that we will have attended and known and understood actually the challenges of sitting with the PC on Environmental Affairs. That's why we thought, therefore, it may be therefore appropriate to put it on that Wednesday, the 28th. That we now look into our MPRTA and finalize it. Because we will have known by then what the compromise that we did and the DMA has raised. If they finalize this, if everything is finalized on the 13th, then it will be easy for us, therefore, to move forward with the MPRTA and the 28th. Then you have the adopting of the budget vote on the following Wednesday. Remember, our budget vote debate is on the 6th of June, so, which will be Friday. I do not know why I always, since I came here, all the committees that I chair, they are only put on Friday. When I was in science and technology, I was always put on Friday. Now I'm in energy, I'm also put on Friday. I do not know whether there is some conflict. Anyway, our budget therefore is on Friday. So we thought that therefore on Wednesday, that Friday we must have the adoption of the budget board. Plus, because adoption of the budget board doesn't take that much long. So we decided to couple it with the energy security master plan working. I think that's how far we looked into this program up to the Friday 6th June. And then we then saw that there are three pieces of legislation under Senate that have been approved by cabinet. They are already, I think, in Parliament now. One of them is the NHS, the other one is the mining and electricity, and the third one is the nuclear risk management bill. So we thought, therefore, that once we have finished with the budget vote and all those things, then we can start looking into the things of this bill. That's why we have on the 11th of June, the briefing was in mine health and testing bill, and then the following Friday. Then we thought that because of the congestion of the program, then we will be on Friday. Hey, Mr. Commander, how am I going to work? My eyes. We have to find, we have there that it's quite appropriate now that we see where we can fit ESCOM, but they are ready to come once we have found a place for them here in this program. So we can look into where we can fit them in here. Let's see where we can fit. Probably, why don't we sit them there on that consideration of MPRDA, because I don't think there will be much thing there, one sort of ironed out on other things. The consideration of MPRDA shouldn't take long, so we can sit them there on the 28th of May. What do you think? Agreed, yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay, so let us just make that addition. So ESCOM will be coming in, and NERSA to put it together with NERSA. Yeah. It must come MSGN carriage.
Just
go and check because Do you think, Honorable Master, we continue with the meeting under the council? What do you think?
As long as they are not going to be controversial.
Okay, right. Then we will continue. Let us therefore allow the members of the department to make their presentation. Let us introduce ourselves to them, although we know one another by now, but probably for procedural reasons, let us introduce ourselves. Oh, yeah. Mr. Kumet, I think you can go ahead.
Thank you, President. Honorable members. We come today to present on the National Energy Committee. We see this as a preliminary presentation on the bill, in that we'll be back here, I guess, in the middle of beginning of June to make the actual presentation on the bill. But I guess what we try to do today is to set the premise. To indicate essentially what the bill is trying to do, and give you, I guess, some drivers as the way that best we say. I'll be doing most of the presentation, but sitting next to me is Mr. Ramon Jesse. She's the Chief Director responsible for Energy Planning. So when we take questions, we'll both handle the questions. It's just a short one. In the presentation, when we're preparing the presentation, the thought that came was, how best do we communicate the needs for the bill? I think that's where I thought that this cartoon was a good way of starting the discussion. It's topical. We all know what's happening with the prices globally, availability, the competition between energy and food. And I think the cartoon captures it. I think the question that we are asking, fundamental question that we are asking, is that as global economies, how do we evaluate, how do we make points? How do we evaluate what the policies, the impact that the policies that we are coming up with, especially on the energy side, the water, I guess, those decisions that we're making, how they would impact on the population? And this cartoon is a clear one that looks at the competition between corn or maize that is now being diverted to produce ethanol for cars, while people are sitting there hungry, asking. And because of the fact that it's competing with the high value commodity like crude, the price of ethanol or corn or maize globally has to then follow the price of oil. Inversely. And the question is, when we came up, and I must admit, the one thing that at least the African government did
was that when the biofuel strategy was approved, it was maize was explicitly excluded from the strategy. But the question that you ask is, what about others? What about even sunflower oil? The sunflower oil is used for making margarine, the making all sorts of cooking oil that we use. Now even that is now competing with the vehicle. The question that we ask ourselves is, do you address a future possible shortage of, because we need to find an alternative energy source. That is for the future. We need to begin now to find a solution for the future. And also to assist in the climate change, in addressing climate change concerns. But you address the questions of the future by creating problems today. Because people are going hungry today. Food prices are going hungry today. I mean, food prices are going high today. But yet, we are trying to find a solution for energy in the future. Now, those are the kinds of debates that we should have. But how should we predict these things up front before the prices go to the prices go to the level at which they are? And then again, I just thought I was putting in this slide, which is there's a test in 2030, but it doesn't change that much. What that slide is indicating is it's asking the question, where do people spend their money? In buying what are the commodities that people buy, or what are those services, goods and commodities that people buy, and therefore how do people spend their money? And those at the bottom there are supposed to be LSM. People that earn the lowest pay, 0 to 9% of the lowest that earn 0 to 9% of all the income that is earned by workers in South Africa. Unfortunately, in South Africa, that happens to be a lot of people. What it indicates there, if you look at the yellow line, at the yellow bar, which gets smaller as you go to the high earners, those that are earning between 95% and 100% of the salary, they are the ones that are taking the bulk of the income, are earning the bulk of the income. If you look at that yellow bar, the poor people in the country spend close on 50% or 40-something% on food. So one might argue that, and we might all talk about food inflation. Bread has increased by 2 rand. Or whatever, milk has done, whatever that the number that you might be putting. But for every 50, if the price of food increases by 50%, it means whatever money that people might have had, they now have to find 50% more from the limited budget that they have to spend on food. So in whatever that we're doing, we should take cognizance of the fact that nowhere in the world, I guess perhaps Europe might be slightly different, that the actual disparity might not be that high. But in a country like ours, that whatever policy you come up with has to address that spectrum and the impact it will have on different parts of the population will vary. The question is then, as we see and develop policy, how do we know how that policy is going to impact on the richer part of South Africa as well as on the poor part? Because the impacts are different depending on. Okay. Having the minister, and I'm just putting up the background. Coming to the data itself, it was first developed in 2003, but its intention was to cover all the aspects of the energy of the energy policy on white paper, which had by that time not been covered by any legislation, and that was its initial focus. And it went to cabinet, was approved for consultation, and it was once converted in 2004, but it was then withdrawn in 2006 before it was introduced to Parliament, largely because we had at that time started thinking around the issues of energy security. And there were unfortunately parts of energy security that were not covered by the bill. And I know we always talk about, and for us it's always important to understand there's a difference between security of supply on one end, it only focuses on supply, versus energy security on the other. And the way we see it, and that's what is captured in the Energy Security Master Plan, is that energy security takes it more than just looking at the supply side. It's also looking at the demand side. It's also looking at the economy. So it looks at issues relating, for instance, to diversity of supply. It looks at issues, for instance, relating to the import and export policies. It looks at macroeconomy. For instance, I'm sure most people will not argue with the fact that we need a South Africa to add value to our mineral, to our mineral products. But the question is, we add value to those mineral products. For instance, if we treat chrome, to process chrome, there is very little we can do with chrome other than to move it from being a chrome oxide to what we see as chrome, which goes to the manufacture of our port. Except by putting large amounts of electricity, because you can't melt, it only melts even with fluxes and things that you might add to lower the melting point. It only melts at temperatures about close to 2,000 degrees centigrade. And the only way that we have of melting at that level would be to pass electricity to it. But it consumes a lot of electricity. But South Africa and Zimbabwe alone have about 85% of global coal reserves. So the question we would have is that, do we then just mine the coal, send it off to other people to process on our behalf, so sell a very low value value product, as we've always done in the past, or do we change and say, okay, we need to begin to add value to our own product? But when we make that decision, we are actually making decisions in respect of energy, because you can't do that without energy. And a lot of our macroeconomic policies actually have a lot of impact on energy. So when you're looking at energy security, you can't look at it without looking at what the macroeconomic policies in the country are coming up with. The issues of energy research. We need to research. We need to find new ways of doing things. And when we're talking about research, it's not just research on finding new energy types, but as I indicated, we need to find new ways of doing things. We might need to find new ways of mobility, new ways of preparing food, new ways of lighting. And that's what energy research is about. Clearly, demand management, infrastructure, because it's one thing to produce energy in a point, but you've got to be able to transport it well. Reserve margin. You need to have contingency plans. That's what that's essentially what that's about. Local production talks to import policy. You have to ask yourself the question, how much do you want this economy to be reliant on imported energy? Foreign policy. Having decided on that, you then say, for instance, in respect of things like crude oil or even electricity for that matter, which countries should we have relationships with? What form should those relationships take if we're going to be reliant for supply of energy or water from those countries? So that's how we actually look at energy security. And it's therefore important that when you look at what we put for you, the National Energy Bill, you have that in mind. Because that's essentially what it's trying to do. That a lot of things in energy security is not just about supply. It's about all the other things that make the provision of energy going forward to be secure. So essentially the energy bill is what we plan to do there, and that the point we're trying to raise is that cartoon at the beginning, to make any policy you need data and information. You need to have data that looks at the current supply situation, at the current demand pattern,
that allows you to be able to then say, in the future, if we make these changes, what is likely going to be the impact? So this bill allows the minister to collect energy data. That's the first part. The second issue is that it then looks at what we collectively call energy development, which is about we need to secure our energy future. To secure our energy future means we need to find alternative energy as well as find alternative ways of doing things. But as part of that, while getting there, we need to make sure that there is efficiency in terms of how we produce the current energy and even efficiency in how we use that energy. And then thirdly, of course, it's about the promotion of research, but make sure it's coordinated, and so it's on both on energy carriers but also in the sector. The third issue that the bill covers is security of supply, clearly. There we're looking at both the energy carrier and also looking at the system. But the fourth issue is this promotion of the concept of a data-driven strategy or policy. And then, of course, the fifth and the most, I guess this is the most important, communication. Right now, for instance, we're sitting with people who don't know what is driving the crude oil price, where is this thing all going, are we going to, and all that people need to know is give us facts, and let us also understand as government when we make decisions on what basis we make those decisions. So essentially what we're looking to do is to collect the data, analyze it, convert it into information, and communicate that information. That's what it is. Again, looking at Ben in terms of some of the background again, I guess I just thought I'll do it, not to indicate this. And it's an issue that they, as most people would know, South Africa is sitting around 7% of our, there was 5 or 7% with a current deficit of, a current account deficit of about 7%. And the point we're trying to raise there is a lot of it from oil. It's not driven largely. The one single issue, the one single item, largest item, other than all these commodities, finished the TVs and the, all the electronic materials we are importing, the one single item that interests our trade balance is the oil. And if you're going to continue to do that, the problem with it is that when on the days when we look at the biggest hit and the biggest drop there, is when we are actually importing finished products. When I'm importing crude and finding it locally, it is not as bad. But since 2005, we're still in the process, and a lot of 2006, and a whole lot more in 2007, and it's going to go on until we have a new refinery in South Africa. That red line is going to go continually down until we come up with a new refinery. Unless, of course, begin to export more. And it can't be more in terms of volume, it's got to be more in terms of value. Something. And I think, you know, again, as I indicated, I would also like to communicate that. I'm going to have some of the graphs that I've given. I just thought I would just give the community a taste of what's going forward. Once we collect the energy data, we should be able to produce. For instance, you always ask the question, is electricity produced by nuclear more expensive than produced by anything? We can have debates on newspapers and have debates and all of these, but those debates are not numbers driven. Those debates are not driven. So what we're hoping to do is to be able to collect the data and make the data available. And as you can clearly see there, that and unfortunately globally we're seeing a lot of with closed cycle gas turbines, but yes, they are cheap in terms of capital, but they are very expensive in terms of fuel. And unfortunately, some of them, they are called the CCGTs or OCGTs, but they're actually using diesel. So the more diesel is used to produce electricity, the higher the deal is what? Unfortunately. Because we are creating another demand for diesel which was not originally there. So those are just the cost indicated in US cents per kilowatt hour based on the figures published by ESCOM in 2007. The point I'd like to raise is the next graph, which for me is the most important, I think, in this one of the slides that we together here. We all know the kind of challenges faced by ESCOM. But the problem with the challenges that are faced by ESCOM, if you look at that graph, which looks at how electricity is demanded from about 4 or 5 a.m. to 6 a.m., and then it's falling off after 10, is that to be able to supply that in terms of electricity is very difficult. Because the most efficient plants, like nuclear plants or all the baseload power stations, don't want to be switched on and switched off. So the only way you supply that peak, which unfortunately in South Africa is a very large peak, it moves from 23,000 megawatts, all the way up to close on 36,000 megawatts. Again, these figures are based on the figures published by ESCOM in 2007. To supply that energy is very, very expensive. It doesn't always come across, and that's the point I wanted to raise, which I'm linking it with this cost. Because the only way you can supply that peak is through things like CCGT. But as you can see, CCGT, in terms of fuel cost, and these were numbers based on 2006 fuel costs, and you know in 2008 crude has not come off 100%. It's always been above $100 a barrel, most likely going to stay above $100 a barrel. That thermal, that peak is bad for us. Let me just show you the numbers. The new load production capacity is down. In ESCOM, the money that goes to ESCOM at the moment, I just put the numbers within US cents kilowatt hour because for one to be able to benchmark my numbers. What goes to ESCOM is 3 US cents kilowatt hour. You can multiply that by 7 or so, 8, whatever number you may choose. But what goes to ESCOM is 3 US cents per kilowatt hour. But in South Africa, most of us, especially in urban areas, we pay about 6 US cents per kilowatt. Unfortunately, this doesn't apply for rural and far off customers, when you go up north and Zebedean and places like that. They pay a whole lot more than that. But electricity does not cost a whole lot more. That additional 3 cents per kilowatt hour is a tax. You go to ask yourself the question. And that tax, I guess, is tax to fund municipality. Is that a fair way of funding municipality? It's not something that is a fiscal question. Something that we are guests. I just put it on the table to debate it. It's got nothing really to do with us, necessarily as the Department of Mineral Energy, but it's a question that needs to be asked. Because the challenge is that at 3 US cents per kilowatt hour, you can't generate electricity. You can't. You just cannot generate electricity. What's worse is that, as you know, that most of the electricity that is currently to service the thermal peak, that is there. That peak I was pointing out up there, all of those peaks. The electricity that's used to supply that peak, most of it actually is generated from diesel. How much does it cost ESCOM just on fuel alone to produce electricity? 60 US cents per kilowatt. 60. That's how much it costs ESCOM. 60 US cents per kilowatt. How much do we pay for it? 6 cents. How much goes to Telecom? 3 cents.
I think it's clear.
Let me check the thing. That is.
That's not something. Unfortunately, even right now, I still don't know how Telecom actually absorbs that cost. How do you sell something for 6 cents, for 3 cents that costs you 6 cents to make?
So, that's the all I'm trying to raise a number. I'm not, that's all I'm just raising, just a number. So, what I'm then saying, when I then say the thermal load is bad for the economy, that's what I mean by that. You can't produce electricity at 67. Consumers should never be asked to pay 67 per kilowatt. And remember, this is just production cost and fuel cost alone. So it still needs to be transmitted, it still needs to be distributed, and tax will still need to be put on that, and it costs you 67 per kilowatt. That's what it calls the short-term marginal cost. But to be able to make any additional investment, you need to at least be able to make, in terms of generation cost alone, you need to be able to be in the order of 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt. If you don't earn 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour, you will not get anyone to make any investment. No one is going to put money in something where they will not at least recover the cost of making whatever they make. Moving off electricity, sound effects, just numbers. I just thought, and this is interesting, yes, in terms of solar, again, I was looking at this in terms of the biofuel debate, and also in terms of the food prices today, but let's communicate this number. And what we're looking at is here is this picture looks good. You know, there's been, in terms of production, if you look at what is consumed, so I've been consumed in South Africa, look at what is consumed. There's been a steady increase, I guess, over years. Look at sunflower. It raises the question. Why is it that, yes, we know the sunflower oil prices have been going up? Why is therefore, okay, perhaps the demand has also been coming down. You know, perhaps that's why production is coming down. But maybe the demand is coming down because, I guess, that's driven largely by the prices of sunflower. But I guess, you know, whatever decisions we make in respect of whatever that we do, be biofuels or whatever, we always need to have an understanding of these numbers. I just thought I'd just put in May. Because May, I guess, is important in South Africa, and you have to understand why, for grain producers, maize would be a concern. That if you look in 2005, 2006 production year, that South Africa produced a whole lot more maize than not consumed, white maize than not consumed. And there was a lot of inventory. So the following year, farmers didn't plant a lot of maize. As you can see, the consumption went up, but the production was down. But there was still a lot more maize that was still sold. So when for instance farmers talk about, you know, we'll use excess maize to produce bioethanol, that's essentially what they're referring to. It's that inventory. It's that low clothing stock that we have in the country. But the question that you always ask is that even if you're gonna use excess anything, who knows what is excess? It needs to be communicated. That data will always need to be communicated. It also just to indicate how much we actually physically import. We only really imported in 2001, 2003, last year or something. But generally, we produce our own maize, white maize. And I would have to say that the market in this case is really working. If you look at the surface, or whatever the South African exchange, the prices of every South African exchange, they are reflective of the export parity, which that's what you would be looking for. That there would, you don't expect a product which is in excess to be priced at import parity. So the market clearly working there, and I guess it's
the market knows how much maize it has, and we can actually see it from the prices, the export prices come to the market in July. Those are future prices.
So down,
no difference.
I guess you look, today you look at the production figure of 2005, 2006, then you look at consumption, less consumption than production, therefore the stocks were high, then the following year the farmers produced less, even though the consumption, but the total stocks were high. So essentially these are the kind of data we would really like to communicate.
It goes back to the electricity.
The point I have to raise with this is what has happened globally, and what the introduction of carbon tax does on production of electricity.
These are data that we got in April of this year from the Energy Information Administration, or the conference in April. If you look at that, if you compare, these are so-called levelized costs, and if you look at the cost when you put a carbon tax of $200 per ton on coal, it's cheaper to manufacture electricity using nuclear. And this is based, again, on 2002 fuel price. If you recall, crude oil at the time, was about $25 a barrel. You look at the same graph, but now looking at 2005 fuel cost, and look at what happened to the gas turbine. But clearly, the solar PV is not affected by the carbon tax, but what is affected by carbon tax and also affected by the fuel cost are clearly gas, coal, and OCGT, open cycle. But that's what then happened. So I guess someone that might have been presenting this data might have been looking into one that was arguing a case for nuclear, but you know, data says they draw for nuclear. That is what data says. I missed that in my slide here. So this slide was supposed to follow the power fuel issue. The point we're trying to raise with the power fuel is that members are following the debate in terms of the US being the biggest driver in terms of use of maize to produce bioethanol for cars. In 2008, they are projecting that they will produce 9 billion gallons of bioethanol for maize. But that number is set to increase to 15 billion by 2015. That means diverting more maize to produce power. What that means, I think, for most economies is that the current maize prices that we see are set to increase. Yes, what also that slide is intended to indicate is that the US is also then looking to produce about a minimum of 16 billion gallons of biofuel from cellulose and other forms of biomass by 2022, their target is to have 36 billion gallons of fuel being manufactured from the world. That's a very ambitious project, but what it does say is that we are set for even higher prices in terms of food if such programs are replicated by other countries. One also just thought, we all know yesterday Brent crude rose up $218 a barrel. The question that is always asked, where is it going? And what is the driver? This is just one view. This is presented by the Lehman Brothers one of the trading companies. What they were saying is that in the past, the crude price, even though it's been increasing a lot, in actual fact has been reflective of the cost of producing crude. So in the past there was a relationship, and there could be a prediction, you could eventually predict what the price of crude was going to be based on the PPI data until recently. That divergence, where the current price that they were saying 9x, that's the US Brent type equivalent, it should be trading, it should have been trading in February at $70 per barrel, but it's at $91. What therefore is happening? What people are saying, and the reason why I'm raising this, is that, you know, it just raises the question, what, how are we seeing crude going forward? Is it going to go down? Is it going to increase? What people unfortunately are saying is that what these numbers are now indicating is that traders, exactly what they did with platinum and gold and all the other commodities, they are now investing in crude itself as a whole lot of value. The problem when that happens is that even when you actually see it in the next slide, that even when the demand falls down, when the demand falls in the value of supply, the price still increases. Where will it end? Gold was $343 or whatever dollars at an ounce not long ago. It went to 900. Platinum, I recall in 1998 or so, was about, was less than, was trading less than gold at 300 and somewhere around 40 as well, an ounce. It went to over $2,000 an ounce. When the traders see a commodity as a whole of value, what happens to the commodity? So, when people are considering the possibility of a $200 an ounce crude oil price, it's because of that. It's not going to be driven by demand. It's driven by other factors other than demand. And the question is, what should then ask the government to do to prepare for? What can government do to prepare for? I guess there was a program yesterday looking at peak oil. I just thought I would throw another view on peak oil. That says we might be running out of crude but it peaked already and it's going to decline. But yes, crude, when it's $28 or $25 a barrel, makes all the other alternatives not viable. But when crude goes above $50, goes above $100, goes above $150, it changes the economy of mining oil. So one view is that we have oil until at least the end of the century, until the start of the 22nd. And this assumes that you can recover most of the oil. But if you can recover less than what the oil that is in the ground, it then changes the picture that will start to peak around 2050. And also, I guess you don't have this one. Apologies. If we have got lower oil deposits. Lower in place estimate than what you originally estimated, but the recoveries are still high, it will start peaking. It will start really going down around 2015. But the question is, when you have things like this, the question you have to ask yourself, what should government be doing? Should we be building more freeways, as was indicated last? But it's not that South Africa has got more cars, but it's that you've got less roads for the cars.
But if you know that that's what's going to happen, and this is a more conservative view in terms of Peacock, what should governments do? Should we be building more? Should we be driving our economy so that we have more cars? When we know we're going to run out of oil. And also we know that oil is going to go up perhaps to $200 a barrel. What should governments do? I guess with those lines, I just thought with an energy planning perspective, I'll just throw those slides to indicate why we then need to have tools that will allow us to better plan, better develop policies, and just to better get a better handle on what actually is happening globally. And therefore, plan accordingly. These are not necessarily extracts of what might be what the bill will actually say. Unfortunately, it's only going to be gazetted, I believe, this week after approval by cabinet. So, just going into the bill itself, looking at what the purpose is. It's really about, and I'm just going to highlight a few issues there. We've discussed it before, so I won't dwell on it. But what it's looking at is about, as we say, energy is about diverse energy resources. When we say diverse, we mean diverse in terms of type, but also diverse in terms of profit. But it's going to be those things that are unsustainable quantities. It's no good to shift people into something that at one moment is not available. So it's going to be unsustainable quantities. But it's also going to be at affordable prices. And affordability is important. And affordability does not mean cheap. It just means affordable. It means it's something that has got to be in relation to what people are earning. And it's going to be available to the South African economy. But all of that is going to be in support of economic growth. Because it's one thing to have energy, but in introducing that energy, all it results in is the economy shrinking. It's also got to address a South African problem or an African problem of poverty. But at the same time, taking into account environmental management and also the interaction between energy and all other economic sectors. One of the issues that the bill looks at is that it introduces an entity, and this chairperson, when he presented, you made suggestions, and your suggestions you made, chairperson, have been taken into account, and you see how you develop it. Look at entities that are going to be in support of energy efficiency, energy modeling, energy planning, generation, research, security of supply, contingency stock, and of course, investment in the upkeep of energy infrastructure. And of course, it has indicated about the supply of certain energy information in respect of demand, supply, and generation, and all the parameters connected there. The principle that are guiding the bill is that it recognizes that energy is an economic incident. Like water. We all need water to survive. The economy is unfortunately needing energy to survive. Without energy, which is the lifeblood of any economy, economies just don't survive. In some economies, it's not about price. Some economies are just about supply because they can afford to buy it at any price. But some economies are saying it's not about supply. Therefore, this one looks at both the availability and price. And it focuses on strengthening energy security. And because energy is like water and land, it's that it's generally applicable. So it touches all aspects of the economy, which results in problems with concurrency. And the point that you want to raise is that when the bill looks at collecting data but all the data that you collect is supposed to complement other data from you and not to replace them. Because of the concurrency that comes out of this thing, the bill itself was written in a manner that takes that into account and only looks at the gaps on areas that are not covered by other legislation. And also all these other programs and initiatives that are proposed that the minister will come up with. The minister will have to come up with those programs and initiatives in consultation with other ministers. And also in respect of appointment of board members and also in respect of regulation. That the minister will come up with. They will all be done in concurrence with the concurrence of other ministers. In coming up with the institution, because what we're trying to do is that we're saying the institutions that are proposed in the bill are not there to replace the department, are not there to take away other people's mandate, but they're supposed to be either executing agents for the minister, or they are supposed to be serving an advisory role to the minister. And we try to create entities in such a way that we to minimize the conflict in terms of giving an entity, you know, to avoid an entity giving conflicting mandate. At one end is supposed to have the cheapest possible price, on the other is supposed to have other things as well, which might, by their very nature, have a fluctuating effect. And it only takes account of published government policy. And once established, when in the establishment, the government other ministers have indicated, but in the main, we're trying to make sure that they're not driven by private agenda. And some of the institutions that are created, they might have representation from industry, and I guess they will have part-time members as well as full-time members. The bill is structured in chapters, 8 chapters. Chapter 1, definitions and objects. Chapter 2, it defines and it will supply information and that, and it will look at the provision of data and access to data. Chapter 3 looks at the energy modeling and information agency, which it creates an agency that is responsible for the collection of data, for its collation, its analysis, and the distribution of information coming out of their analysis. And then chapter 4, of course, looks at energy planning. And then chapter 5, that's where what we've done is initially with propose that we create 3 different entities for renewable energy, energy efficiency, and energy research. It's now been combined into one entity called the Energy Development Institute. And then Chapter 6 looks specifically at security of supply, Chapter 7 energy infrastructure, and Chapter 8 general provision. Again, I'll skip through most of this. But in the main, in terms of data, there's a mandate for provision of data and information. And what we're also then proposing is some kind of connection between existing systems that are also collecting and managing data and information within government to facilitate a better transfer and sharing of information. And then on safety, health, and environmental issues is that there will be programs that are looking at that minimizing the negative impact of energy carriers on the environment, on health, and safety. That might include coming up with new standards and specifications, but all that will be done in consultation with the DPI and the Department of Environmental Affairs and Policy. And then of course there's any aspect of our programs related to that, and programs related to
international coordination, international obligation. That's also the end of five. I guess we discussed a lot on this. Why did we look at this? About the fuel shortages in 2005, electricity shortages in 2007, and current, and also the opportunity that everyone is planning parallel to each other, the no integration, especially the fact of energy. So we needed to come up with a coordinated and integrated view of what we expect of any plans and policies on energy. And the, if you look at energy, integrated energy modeling and planning, as indicated in terms of what the energy, what the energy modeling and information agencies are looking at, is going to be about provision of high quality, policy neutral energy information that will promote sound policy making. It will provide that to cabinet, to national, provincial, and local governments, to provide it to market for efficient market operations, and it will also provide it to the public. And that data will be used both in terms of modeling, but also used for planning purposes. So again, I'm just repeating myself here, what the integrated energy modeling agencies are doing, collecting, compiling, and analyzing energy data and information. It will publish the energy data, some of it, but it will publish it as taking into consideration the Access to Information Act. And it might publish analysis that it will do daily, weekly, and monthly analysis, and will do energy annual energy reviews, and will also do energy forecast. That's what it will be looking at. In respect of the energy plan, the bill talks about the production of an integrated energy plan, a master plan, which will have a 25-year planning horizon. It will be produced in an integrated manner. It will use the output of energy modeling, but it will be informed, and it also informs other plans, which are looking at demand, supply, and all the other production methods. And to just put that graphically, essentially what we're saying is that in developing the integrated energy plan, it would be done in conjunction with all the government entities and SOEs, like there might be an electricity plan, as an NTT1, but using data coming out of energy modeling, combining that and all the other plans. For instance, if housing is looking to develop a particular community or a particular township, clearly it has to take into account availability of electricity. And so all we wanted to do is that when housing does plan, we, people in electricity, are aware of the plans that housing has, or if there are plans that are being developed by transport, that those plans take account of the availability of energy. And annually, an integrated energy plan will be published, which is a coordinated plan. Again, there's another view of the same thing. So if we look at the entities, Jefferson indicated, we now have this one, but we now really have two entities that have been created. But the entity, the first entity is the South African National Energy Development Institute, and it will be responsible for energy efficiency, for renewable energy, and also for R&D. And it's a transitional arrangement there where we are proposing that the CEO, the current CEO of Saleh, be transferred to the new entity, but the current equivalent to the member of the contract. And all the personnel that currently exist in the entities that are doing energy efficiency, renewable energy, and R&D, that they are transferred to the new entity, as well as all assets
liability. So the next one really just looking at what the renewable function would be. It could be a division within the institute. And energy efficiency would also be a division within the institute. But the one point I'd like to stress there is that what we are trying to do is to make sure that each energy carrier pays for its own efficiency program. So we don't have electricity consumers paying for efficiency of liquid fuel. And then of course energy research, it should also be another division of energy. And the bill talks about security of supply. The main point that you want to raise there is that, and the key issue here, the biggest driver, is that in most cases there is inadequate stock which is held by the energy industry. Point in question could be the amount of coal, for instance, that is held by Eskom as inventory. And that energy stock in question here would both be commercial and strategic stock. And it should look at primary energy and also finished energy. And in the sector of liquid fuels, it will create this national liquid fuel reserve stock capacity, or the strategic stock as it's most known. And that would be held by perhaps an entity within that on behalf of the state. Infrastructure, because of our location in the globe and also in terms of how South Africa develops, for instance, electricity generation power is largely in the eastern part, in the northeastern part of South Africa, Mpumalanga and Maine, and also now expanding to the northern part of South Africa, that it then needs to be distributed from where it creates, from where it's generated, it needs to be distributed to the rest of South Africa. So there's always a need for an integrated view of all the infrastructure investment in South Africa. With that, Chapter 10, thank you.
See that the DME uses the word energy crisis, because once you acknowledge the problem, you can start working at getting to the solution. So it might want to be just a welcome usage of that phrase. But on a more serious note, I think the purpose of the energy bill seems to be indicated on your schedule, dealing with the impact of high oil prices on the trade balance, the integrated approach, as you can see. How far is the industry in providing, this is a very specific issue, not on a general basis, but how far is industry in terms of government facilitating? I know there's a possible economy by, I think it's Tesla, there's talk of another possibility. What's the status at this point in time if you're in a position to do so? Because that puts in a bigger picture as to how the development improves. Secondly, I'm not quite sure, on the next slide, you have just some background, some facts. You have nuclear high growth and nuclear low growth. I don't understand the nuclear low and nuclear high. I'm not sure what you mean by that. Then I do seem to miss on that same graph. There seems to be, and I'm not an engineer, I'm not open cycle or closed cycle gas turbine technology, but there seems to be a difference between open cycle gas turbines and closed cycles. I don't see the open cycle gas turbines, which, if I understand correctly, is the cause of the high usage of diesel. I see the closed cycle gas turbines, are they lumped together, or is there some other explanation for that? And quite honestly, the background, or the statement dealing with background from fact, the levelized cost comparison for electric power generation was the $200 per ton tax on carbon. That graph, you've lost me, if you wouldn't mind just saying that. For due to poor, it shares levelized cost comparison for electric power generation. It deals with the $200 per ton tax on carbon, 2002 fuel price. I'm not with you on the purpose and the there. That's for the moment for the question I'd like to ask. Thank you.
This policy. I know this is not yet the deal itself,
These are the objective and the motivating factors. My second question is, I see I have a concern with this bill. My concern is that if I look at it as a whole from your presentation, I do not see why this should be presented as a bill instead of as a strategy. To me, this is a strategy, a very welcome strategy, a very positive strategy to address some gaps. Not supposed to be, not supposed to be communicated into policy, because we already have the policy. We already have, as you say, even thinking of legislation, there's a variety of these things. Actually, that's why I'm asking, is Saneri requesting Saneri, because there is already a piece of legislation that forms Saneri as a list. And so it's a matter of changing the functions, augmenting the functions of Saneri in the energy development that we put in, into Saneri. It doesn't have to have a bill. And so to me, this is a strategy rather than a policy. In fact, if you look into very successful economies like Sweden, I think I did say this thing last time when we were here. You know, part of some inefficiencies in our approach here in South Africa, I have noted, is that we create a lot of these entities. And you see, the more you create a lot of these entities and bodies, the more you are creating disjointness in approach, and the more you are therefore creating even the conflict of opposites, and the more therefore you are reducing the coordination of policy. And that is a very, very shortcoming that we have to deal with. If you look into the strategies that have been used, I think it's a very National Party government when they are developing the strategies about taking the Afrikaner from record communities to advanced level. They created singular institutions that focus in exactly this on energy, on petrol, transport, ESCOM, the part of that, and that is exactly what they do in economic they, you know, the Ministry of Science and Technology in Sweden, they only consist of 15 big funds. 15. The whole Ministry of Science and Technology, yes, look at the Swedish technology policy. It's one of the best in the world. And then they leave the institution to be driven by this ministry of 15 people. That is the ministry of the staff, they all include the policy. And that brings efficiency and coordination of policy. And I think these are some of the things that you must think about. Coming back to the 30 cents per kilowatt versus 50 cents per kilowatt, I think you are an advocate of the price hike. that is how I stand. That you are advocating you can't imagine how Eskom survives paying 50 cents for only coal and only 30 people to sell per kilowatt hour. Then I think they should make you the chairman of that. On the contrary, actually, you see, if you read, I'm worried about that because we have a policy in this government since 1994, which is fundamentally based on the accessibility of energy by the poor. That is the question. And then we have a policy, because we can't have a state that is not driven by the policies of the ruling of the mandated party. And the mandated party is the African National Congress. And the African National Congress took congressional resolutions in Polokwa. That one of the fundamental resolutions is that South Africa is a development nation. And once we define it as that, it means that they had to intervene, especially to advance the poor. And energy, just like water, are fundamental and highly natural in the Constitution. And once you start to deal with those issues, looking at international markets, regardless of policies that are maintaining between the mandated part and the country as such, then you have missed the point. So anything that a bill like this one does has to really be aligned with the policies of the ruling party or the mandated party. And once it advocates that there should be price hike of more than 6 cents per kilowatt hour, then it is already defeating the constitutionality, I mean the resolutions of the mandated party, the contract of the developmental state, and so forth and so forth. So, let me tell you how other countries have addressed this issue. These are issues, LAG is a very fundamental economic component of a developing society. And is a strategy, not policy, as you have made the policy, because once you have tried it into the legislation, then it's policy. But if it is a strategy, various strategies can be used. Part of it is what they call demographic, geographic, cross-fertilization of things. And that is where we come in, where it is able to address them questions. Looking into components of what you just said, looking into energy and all other components that affect the energy efficiency, but also not letting off the hook the central policy, our state is what is the development of state, and therefore accessibility of energy should be paramount to the state. The OCGT, again, the OCGT and the CCGT, I have also seen that, I am wondering, as they have put it in this, it turned out vulnerable to cost of business. But you see, I am wondering why have we not thought of the distributed energy strategy? Because the distributed energy strategy is founded upon the concept of what they call DEPs, distributed energy plants or distributed energy resources, where you have, in fact, it ranges from renewables, fossil, but at distributed localities. And it is able and it's very easily accessible to the poor. It is very it is also close, it doesn't need a lot of transmission lines. So it's economic. And this has been used in many countries as an additional to the baseload out of the country. And it really does take a lot of battery from the grid load. And the OCGTs, they have all what you have said, the CCGTs and all this, they have all of your side as a disadvantage. And if we probably look into the DES and DEPs, probably we can have something better than I don't know. That's why I am for it.
Can I start by challenging? And sometimes when we get carried away with the numbers. The point with the background blast that I was trying to raise, with all the numbers that I was putting up there, is saying the energy bill is only what it's trying to do is to assist us in collecting data, in analyzing that data, and in disseminating the information that is derived from the data. That's what the bill is about. It is up the graphs that are all the data, all the background slides are put up. Not just asking the question that in the past, how have we been making decisions if we don't have data? That's all it says. He then says, yes, you can have data. Data means very little unless we have a way of interpreting what the numbers are saying to you. He then says, the bill does create an opportunity or an entity that will facilitate our being able to take what the numbers that we get and translate them into useful information. That's what the bill is trying to do. The intention, what I remember, was not to scare you with the numbers. The intention was to say, why is it at the moment, perhaps what we're not doing, is that sometimes we're not communicating to people. And also we ourselves as we develop, as the policy makers, especially the mandated party, as it arrives at the decision, we have to make sometimes very difficult choices. And it makes those choices within an environment which, unfortunately, is a globalizing environment. It can't make, it, in terms of decisions, the choices are not limitless. Because, unfortunately, we exist within a system, a global system. So, Jefferson, the point of this trying to raise with the numbers, which scare me too. When I hear crude price going to $200 a barrel, Jefferson, I just think it to be useful, it's easy to just hide and say let someone else worry about it. Because if we had a 50 cents, 55 cents a litre increase this month, and we have yet another one next month, and we have yet another one next month, or whatever the issue might be, someone has to explain that. It is very difficult to explain. So always then asking is that, I think let's get an opportunity so that people can make on it. And unfortunately, even some of the classes that you see, even with the liquid fuels, for instance, where the classes are going, some of that is driven by people making, saying there was a problem in Nigeria, so it's like, whatever the problem might be in Nigeria, therefore the prices go up. Why? It's because people don't have information. So they speculate based on, and all that energy bill is trying to do is, let's not speculate, let's base things on numbers. That's what it's trying to do. So I'm really hoping that, you know, I got carried away in terms of showing you the numbers. Perhaps, you know, there will be a time in the future when the numbers will come, but these are the typical numbers that we should have in our disposal as we make decisions. And Jefferson, with this number,
do we need the bill for number?
Unfortunately, Jefferson, people don't volunteer data. and even if when they do, you can't guarantee the quality of the data. And unfortunately, if you're making, as they say, if you're starting with bad data, you will have a bad analysis, you'll come up with a bad policy. So it all starts with good numbers. So that's unfortunately, that's one thing. And also the bill creates an modeling agency. The bill tries to come up with an energy planning tool, an approach which is mandated, and it publishes something, and of course with the entities, I'll respond to some of your questions. I was trying to just maybe start with this one, which is, what does it mean? I am not, with this figure, with this figure of 10% advocating for. All the point I'm trying to raise is that, as I, with this slide, I'm saying we have to find a solution for thermal. Because what is never told is that unless we find a solution for the thermal peak, Chairperson, the only way to supply the electricity is by the OCGT. Well, if including, if I guess Chairperson, people, as long as someone is generating their own electricity and as long as they're not using diesel, which unfortunately is also a problem. But we have to find a solution to that. Because if we don't, invariably, to be able to supply those peaks and be able to start up a plant in the morning and shut it down again, the only plants that are amenable to that are the OCGT. As long as we have those peaks, we will have ESCOM spending 60 cents per kilowatt hour. And you ask Deputy Chair, Acting Chair, why did you have said, it's more for, we are in a global world, it's easy to communicate, but we can multiply that by 7 and you will get how much that quality actually costs. Which is all the point I'm trying to raise here is that what energy modeling and energy data does, it allows you to make, to understand those things, number one, and come up with solutions which are not about coming up with more plants, newer plants, based on fuel or diesel, but addressing what the actual problem is. The problem is not more plants. I'm not sure that that's the message I'm trying to make. The problem for me is not coming up with more plants, but it's addressing the peak. So that was the message. It was not advocating. Okay, so I thought I would just start with that before. But going through the question one by one, just starting with Magush. The state of the new refinement. That's an easier one. We have two takers. We have Sasol has indicated interest in building another synthetic fuel refinery. And the price is about $100 a barrel, and if those prices stay around about $100 a barrel, and they are projected to stay around like that, those projects are very, very, very low. That's number one. But that is, unfortunately, projected to come on stream by around 2014. PetroSA has also indicated and they're going ahead with the planning and the business study to build another refinery based on crude oil, on imported crude oil, but not Brent. Imported crude oil that what is termed very heavy crude and most likely not from the Middle East, but imported from other countries. South America and Texas. So, and that would be a very big refinery. They will announce it, I think, on time, but the plans are very well advanced for that. So that one, unfortunately, it takes about 4 to 5 years to actually physically build one. So then a lot of numbers that need to be crunched between that and the time of the decision is finally taken. On the other, again, honourable members, the other graph, this number, for instance, you ask what the nuclear high and nuclear low would be. I mean, these are ESCOM numbers. I'll just put in the numbers, and they will use these numbers to make decisions. But it's really, I guess, in most of them, it's about different technologies. If they use a particular type of technology or if they use a different type of technology, you get different types of numbers coming up. And yes, there is no OCGT here. No one puts OCGT. Which is why it's all, and that is always a miscommunication. Because you design CCGT, you assume you're going to use gas, and it's going to be a closed circuit turbine with efficiencies of 60% or so.
When in actual fact, like in South Africa, do we have gas? No, we don't. So that's why the president is in Qatar, or was in Qatar, to try to develop the council. But before you get gas, what do you use? You use diesel. So you take crude, you add value to crude, and then you burn it to produce electricity. And what are the efficiencies you get? 30%, maybe 40%. Unfortunately, even in producing, forgetting just even about the efficiency, conversion efficiency, but the cost of diesel as a fuel is very, very expensive. So if we were to put all the GTs in this graph, it would drop everything else. So, but I guess no company goes out there and wanting to use a diesel necessarily to produce electricity because it's not the most efficient way of doing it. It's not the most cost-effective way of doing it. Again, the same goes for the concept of levelized cost. Remember, the thing that I wanted to raise here was the issue around the actual comparison. But what people do is they do ratios. So this levelized, whatever, they're leveling it to a ratio. So they do those ratios to compare, again, because there is a huge difference between electricity coming out of solar and solar thermal versus electricity coming out from coal. So you need to ratio things to be able to plot them in the same graph. And that's what those are ratio numbers. But that's what is indicating that in terms of proportion, it costs proportionally, it costs so much to produce electricity using solar PV as compared to nuclear. So that was the intention. Again, I've looked at the information scarce people. I do believe that people out there deserve to know the truth. They have a right to know the truth. They have a right to know numbers. Members of parliament have a right to have numbers. When we come with policies, we should firstly give you the numbers. There was an issue right around, like, I remember around, we come up with nice policies, but they never live up to, or some of them don't live up to the expectations. And a lot of them is because when we put them forward, we will never quite say what assumptions we made when we developed those policies. Or when we develop those programs, when we come and propose programs that we come up with, we don't even identify therefore the challenges that could well be faced when we implement. Take biofuels. Biofuels is one of those strategies that we have better developed. For instance, as indicated, you know, perhaps South African government could well be one of the few in the world that yes, we will do the biofuels, but firstly, we'll have biofuel program, but firstly, we'll also have a pilot first. We will pilot them. We'll only allow 2% of fuel to be produced by biofuel, number one. Number two, the European government said, you know what, maize is used by our people as a primary feedstock. We will exclude it from biofuel. The reason why that decision was made also, I guess, members of cabinet had the data that looked at the price of maize and where it was going, and they said, are we going to be contributing and exacerbating it? That's the power of numbers. But yes, in terms of our fuel, for instance, when we're looking and saying how many jobs, rural jobs, will be created by it was a number driven policy formation. And that's what we are advocating. The GMOs, they are hard. I'm afraid I will not comment on it, but I think it is a concern. I think in terms of sunflower oil trust, I didn't even put it up there, but it is easy to predict some of these things. When you're coming up with an strategy, as long as you've got a model, a proper model, you can predict what is likely going to happen, looking at demand and supply, because we can be able to predict.
the chances are we could have better. And unfortunately, it's also a global phenomenon. Because now you have competition for cooking oil. Cooking oil is competing with diesel. Yeah. You put it in your car or you put it in your port. But which one is that? Oil, which is cooking oil going into our cars or should be going into our port? Yeah. So we've been. The price at which you have buy oil, that's another, I'll not comment on that. Red, there's a very important question to ask. All we are saying here, and what Red is about, is saying, Red is saying municipalities need funding. Currently, unfortunately, the only thing to collect funding on is electricity. And unfortunately, if you are collecting that electricity levy and using it for the general upkeep of the distribution, it will be okay. And using some of it perhaps to fund other activities. But the challenge we have in South Africa is the number that been quoted. Is that we have something like a 40 billion deficit, 40 billion rand deficit in terms of infrastructure that needs to upgrade as municipality. At some point, this economy has to find 40 billion to upgrade some of the infrastructure, distribution infrastructure that we have at the municipality. What that means is that EFCON and IPP. We both like to make investments up in terms of infrastructure to generate electricity. They might even make investments in terms of the transmission capability, but to get it to home, we have a deficit of 40 billion. Where is the economy going to find that 40 billion? And even when it finds it, how is it going to be distributed? And the question is, if for every kilowatt hour that you consume, there is about 3 cents that's being collected from the consumer. Why is it not spent in upkeeping? So essentially that's what the EDI is supposed to do. It recognizes that as a fact. And then it then says, okay, you can still collect some revenue from the electricity user to find other things. And that's the issue around tax, if that's the best way to do it. That's what EDI is. Another question about EDI. So, and it's a question that unfortunately this economy at some point will have to deal with. We can't run away from it. Okay. So that's what the EDI is supposed to do. I think chapter 10 about the bill, it's only when you see the actual bill chapter 10 that I think we'll make a judgment. But anyway, the bill, what it's trying to do is there are entities that it says. You are for instance about Faneri Chemperson. Faneri was not created by a chief administration. It was created by a directive to serve to create the entity. Unfortunately what it does is that it leaves governance structures changing. For instance, if you're looking at another entity, a division that is created under the same entity, Faneri, a division which was responsible for energy efficiency. That division will most likely be handling about 10 billion rand of electricity money per annum, or whatever that money might be, or a billion rand, just a billion rand. You can't, as a state, entrust 1 billion rand to something that doesn't have a proper government structure, that doesn't have proper reporting, that is not doing well controlled. And what this bill does is create the entity, it legalizes, it creates a legal entity. Properly created and properly governed. That's what the bill is. But it also, again, as I indicated, we need to collect data, it legalizes the collection of data. We need to come up with a plan. We need to create a plan of the economy, it does that. The other issues, chapter 10 around cross fertilization, those are policies, such as geographic cross fertilization, those are policies that. The bill will not interfere with, all it will do is it will test
impact of any of those policies.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that one that's something about the minister being in Qatar, and that they followed the story, and I thought that because you're coming here, you will also be able to support the person you are filled to get. I understand Qatar. I didn't know that Qatar he can reserve of gas in the world. And can you brief us on this arrangement? Because I have a minister saying that indeed things are looking good. And I know your program, which you said that you are starting your program of gasification of South Africa. How does it fit with the my concern, which has always been until today, ever since this question of Eskom being expanding the problem of electricity, weak funds, that they have got to be found somewhere. You see, not a single day I have heard someone saying, since Eskom has been a public utility, since Eskom has been working not at a loss, at a profit, since Eskom has not had any development program since 1994. I've never heard someone saying this. That accumulation of profit from Eskom, that money has got to be now utilized as likely to do that. I've never had any. Any time they are looking for money from somewhere, they should look for someone. But in fact, Eskom has also not had a problem when it wants to give the bonuses to its executive to look for money elsewhere. It takes it from someone. But nobody says that. Why are they not taking the money from what they purchased for the bonus? And it's been, until today, really, Eskom has been working at a monopoly profit ever since its inception. And nobody is saying, and our economy, the Minister of Finance has always been saying, is doing well, it's helping some surplus. Outside Eskom, I'm not talking about, because if Eskom then was subsidizing the state, I would understand that when the money goes to subsidize the state, but the state is, they were told the stars is doing well in itself. So, where does the profit of Eskom go to? That is the question. Because that is the pool where they should take that money from to upgrade its expansion capacity program. Yes. So I think if people can answer me today, I will rest in peace.
Mine is on the increase of the disposal. What's going to happen to the poor of the poor? Where as government is saying that they have to have the free electricity? Are they still going to be able to get the free electricity?
Mine is a community. I just want to know who at this station, who is it actually focusing on, who is the main beneficiary? I understand that government is able to be, but who are we actually living in, who are actually benefiting, who are the stakeholders in the who are the benefits of the
thank you. I just have a short question. You referred to the EDR restructuring board, and it's of great importance in terms of the distribution of electricity. When do you expect that board to be ready? Because we would have had a meeting this morning on the program. When can we expect movement on that?
I don't think that board will be able to move anytime soon.
Okay.
Because it's still stuck in the cabinet.
Okay.
Okay. You know why? Because you know municipalities, they want to have a bigger control over that, and so there is a little bit of some discrepancy. So I don't think it would be able to go on.
I think our only answer is one or two. But there are for thermal, for cooking, for heating, for whatever, which is, as you can see, the winter, the peak one in winter, for instance. We're going to have another one in June of this year, or something around a peak of that sort. That, unfortunately, and remember, you have now add another 5% on top of whatever number you see here, add another 5% in terms of demand, because demand is gone. We need a thermal solution. We need to find a solution that will address our thermal needs. And the global solution for thermal is gas. So, as I indicated, Chairperson, we might want to start with LPG to create a base load. But our view in the future is that, and if we can find gas now, if someone is interested to introduce the gas for thermal purposes, that's what we should aim. In actual fact, that low peak, we should be aiming as an economy to identify which exactly are the sources of those peaks. And how do we address the demand and the large demand? And that's what the minister is in Qatar for. Yes, Qatar has got about, has got over. They just to indicate, Jefferson, the cool gas sales in Namibia have got 1.3 TCF of gas, to them to the future gas. The gas in Namibia, Panda is about 3, Panda in the mine, 3 TCF. Qatar has got over 867 TCF. And in the, especially in one field that they co-own with Iran, Iran has got about another 100 or so. So, no, there are serious reserves of gas in Qatar. And we'll be hoping that, yes, that we can import gas from Qatar, but we do have neighbors like Angola, who themselves have got a lot of gas, but they don't have a market. And if we go up north, there's a lot of gas as well as the Nigerian gas. And as for Jefferson, I will not attempt to answer the question. And all I would just simply say is that, as we indicated, Jefferson, Eskom is an SOE, state owned entity. It is owned by the state. It pays dividends, has been paying dividends. That's one. But in terms of your question, well, about the increase of 53%, is that firstly, if we can address and not have to invest in new electricity generation, but in finding a solution to that, the need for even more capacity might follow. Or at least that need might be reduced. Or at least we'll be investing not so much in energy in OCGT to be able to handle those peaks, but to be investing in baseload capacity, which does not require much of an investment. But also, considering the fact that you've got that tech to play with, we have choices to make. We can make choices that are relevant choices. Let's say, should we punish the producer? Because the producer, any producer will not be able to produce at less than the cost that it costs them to produce. Or should we just remove the tenant? Those are the choices we still have. Because if you remove the tax, we can even double the electricity price. And to the consumer, we won't see the impact. So it's those kinds of choices that it's going to be choices. But if we don't collect the tax, then you're going to collect it somewhere else. So again, those are the kinds of choices that if you are responsible for fiscal policy, you've got to think about. The beneficiaries of this bill, widespread. We think government has to be the biggest beneficiary. And it's really about all we are asking. Okay, there are certain parts which are clear, security of supply, coming up with an emphasis on security of supply that benefits everyone. In that we have to make sure there is fuel. I mean, we didn't have fuel in 2005, for example, in December. We know what's going to happen. In terms of security of supply, we didn't have coal to feed into power plants. We all know what happened. So the beneficiaries there are general public. But the biggest beneficiary for Rockville has got to be government. Because all it says to government, we want them to be able to create an opportunity to come up with data-driven strategies and policies. And also an ability to test your policies before you need it. And that's all I'm going to do. So the bigger beneficiary for this one is data. And the energy bill, I will not be able to do this part.
I'm glad that finally we are came and to say I'm very glad about that. And because the evening I talk about it. That is what it is. That is the strategy, but the beautiful part. Right, thank you very much. I think we have come to the end of this presentation, but I think it was quite a very useful interaction. This we have the idea of what this energy bill is all about now. But how long are we going to start really working on it now in full swing?
We hope to come to the university this year, where we should be to go for certification and translation and the grant for the
I think we've come to the end of our